We are starting the show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and story, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and mysticpete on social media. In today's show, I interview station favorite George Serra. Before the interview, I play Over Fire, a song he created with an early project of his called THC. After the interview, his song Lost Land from his later project Stereotaxic Device. Then a tune called Blood Pressure from the band Mute Math. This is part of Mrs. Krishnan's Party by the India Inc. Theater at the Broad Stage till July 24th. Then a selection from a lovely piece by Ervil Pärt called Spiegel I'm Spiegel, Mirror in the Mirror. That will be featured in Airplay by Acro Bufos, also at the Broad, July 21st through the 31st. Broadstage.org for more information about Mrs. Krishnan's Party or Airplay. After the Pärt selection, we'll hear Chopin's beautiful Nocturne No. 2 in E flat major, performed by Arthur Rubinstein. That to get you ready for Hershey Felder's Chopin in Paris, now at the Wallace in Beverly Hills through July 24th. TheWallace.org for more information about that show. And then we'll wrap things up with a song from the musical Moulin Rouge, now at the Pantages Theater through September 4th, BroadwayInHollywood.com for more information about Moulin Rouge. Stay tuned! Thank you. It's June 29th, 2022. I'm Mystic Pete, and the station I'm broadcasting this on, KXLU, has broke a number of important acts like Beck and Nirvana. And I am very excited for a new discovery in music here today. I'm sure he's going to blow up, this gentleman named George Serra. Feels like I've known you for a decade. Feels like you've been a guest on my show many times. It feels like I've featured your music many, many times on my shows. I guess it's just a case of double deja vu. Deja vu a vu. George Serra, talk to me.
Hello, Los Angeles and beyond. Thank you for listening.
You have quite a history. And now it's all like coming to a, you know, it's all happening right now for you. Let's talk about George Serra. From whence did you emerge?
I was born in Seoul, South Korea. And I grew up in Palos Verdes. And I got the heck out of Palos Verdes. And then I lived in L.A.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of the short end of it.
And you started in, I guess, like, metal, dark wave, punk.
Never metal. I started out, I guess we were mods when we were 12, 13. We weren't really mods, but we thought in our brains we were mods. We were really into The Who and The Jam, and, you know, we were like, okay, you know, we played Rickenbacker guitars, and so we thought we were mods living in Palos Verdes. But it started there, and then I discovered Bowie and Kraftwerk and electronic music, and then I got into goth and industrial and just whatever, but never metal. Sorry.
Wow.
Yeah.
Not metal.
Never.
But everything
never,
but everything, that's what I meant to say.
Metal,
you've been into everything but metal.
Yeah.
Didn't I say that?
Yeah.
And so there's been quite an evolution. You tried a lot of different genres.
I don't know if I would say the word try. I just got involved in a lot of different, you know, like it was never conscious. It was like, oh, my brother has a drum machine. Let me mess around with that. And, oh, this sounds pretty cool. And so when I was 14, I saw Wall of Voodoo play at my high school, and they had a drum machine. And it was the first time I heard a drum machine. And it was like, wow, that thing sounds incredible. So prior to that, I didn't think you could be in a band and get away with playing, you know, a drum machine. But after I saw that show, I was like, you know, yeah, let's incorporate a drum machine. So yeah, so these things, you know, you're influenced, you get inspired, and then you just kind of gravitate to what's inspiring you. And yeah, I guess if being at the right place at the right time and having access to music and seeing live music, all those things kind of, you know, because if I was like living in a farm in the Midwest, you know, I'd probably be wearing overalls and playing the banjo.
Well, what did your parents want you to do? What did they want you to be when you grew up?
Whatever. My father had a high regards for the arts.
Oh.
His mother was an opera singer, but she gave that up to raise a family. So my parents were taking me to the Hollywood Bowl when I was 6, 7 years old. And
so they helped cultivate all
my
this.
Dad was the type of guy that would listen to Pavarotti and cry.
Mm.
He was like one of those guys.
People cry when I play the cello, but I think it's because I'm a little out of tune.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you were kind of just very creative kid, and the music just started like popping out of you.
Yeah. Popping out everywhere.
That's amazing. Yeah. And you explored, you ventured through various chambers of the arts. And
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I gotta cite David Bowie as that, because I felt like when I was growing up listening to his music, you know, I would listen to Ziggy Stardust, and then I would listen to, like, the Low Record, and it was so different. And I just, that made such an impression on me that I thought, wouldn't it be great to always kind of do something different with every record and every release and kind of venture off and stuff. But it was always good. No matter what he did, it was really good. And I thought, you know, doing that, not to sell out, but to do that, to really expand your horizons as an artist. So it was more like trying different things because you're inspired. It wasn't like, because it sort of worked against me in many ways, because I got success with my old band, like THC, and then it's like I just couldn't do it anymore. And then I, you know, and we were like, you know, I turned down a residency in Madrid, Spain. We had recorded for Network Records in Vancouver, and we had a residency in Paris, and we, you know, were playing all these big shows, and I just couldn't do it. We're on Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know, all this stuff, and I just couldn't do it anymore. And then I had a band prior to that, Stereotaxic Device, which is industrial. Our second album was distributed through Rough Trade Records in Europe. We toured a festival, a tour of Europe, and I just, after that, I couldn't do it anymore. I just wasn't, you know, I couldn't do industrial, like, that kind of music anymore, and I just, and I just had to, you know, like, and it wasn't like I was making a ton of money with these things anyway, so it wasn't like it was like a easy decision. It was hard though, knowing that I had a lot of people who like really loved it and said, you know, is that recording?
Yeah. Just to make sure.
Okay, yeah, I was making sure. Okay. I could repeat everything I just said.
No, it
would be. It's scripted. I rehearsed this last night a couple of times.
Yeah, you had your writers write this all out.
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
your team.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, I think your story is more common than not in that artists, musicians, a lot interests us in a lot of different directions. We're creative people, and we get some success in one area, but then we want to go into another one. I think Bowie was one of the few artists that could change directions and put on different masks and still be very successful.
Absolutely.
But most people, like, now they want to hear your top 40 hit, you know, and after the 1,000th time you played it, you're just
can't stand it. Right, or you do that reunion tour, and then you do the farewell tour, and then you do another farewell tour because you're just like, you know, you're playing your stuff from, you know, 40 years ago, whatever it is, you know. So, and I don't ever play any of my old stuff either. Like, it's whatever. I mean, it has a life, and you do it, and then you move on and stuff. So I don't know.
Well, you then found your way over to electronica.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, maybe is a little bit of an overarching label for you. I don't know. Please correct me.
Well, to me, it's like, I remember the day when it was announced this genre is called electronica, and I didn't buy it. I was like, that's baloney. It was like 96 or 97. It was right around when Prodigy and all these bands were like, you know, releasing records that were debuting on number one in the U.S., and they came up with this name, electronica. But in the 80s, when I was listening to electronic music, Brian Eno and Tangerine Dream and stuff, it was never called electronica. It was just, it was like ambient or electronic music, or Aphex Twin, people called it IDM, intelligent dance music. You know, they had these other kind of to describe it.
Not EDM, IDM.
IDM,
thank
no, we
you.
Don't want to go EDM. Yeah, I'd rather play metal than EDM. So that's how much. Anyways, there's nothing wrong with EDM, you know, but just it's not my thing. So so I wouldn't say I've ventured in electronic music, but it was never a conscious decision. It was like instruments laying around, you know. I was joined my older brother's band. There was a Pro One. It's a keyboard, an analog monophonic synthesizer. And, oh, wow, this sounds really cool. And, you know, the drum machine, start programming it. It was also logistics when I started Stereotaxic Device. We couldn't find a drummer that wanted to do that kind of music. It was industrial. It was before Nine Inch Nails. It was the 80s. And it was like, okay, how do we, you know. So for my birthday, my father bought me a drum machine. And then that became like the writing tool for that band, Stereotaxis, you know. And,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so it wasn't like we're gonna exclude people. It was like, you know, in those days, it was hard to find people that wanted to do, you know, experimental electronic industrial music, because it was the peak of hair metal in LA. So it was just, I put out ads and it was like, you didn't get any responses. So, you know, it wasn't like, some of this was like, you make do with what you got kind of thing, you know. At the time, it wasn't like I was like trying to be revolutionary. I was like, well, I guess it's me in the box. You know? It's like, okay. So.
Well, I think in 100 years or
200. I would say 200.
200 years.
I would say 200.
200 years. When they are doing the George Serra retrospective, you're going to be considered more in this line of classical composers, actually.
Really?
I mean, you're really a composer. And if Mozart or Beethoven or Bach were alive today, they would be using electronics too. You know, and they were, of course, fine musicians in their own right, which you are, but they were really composers. They were really coming up with musical ideas. And that's what you do, and use a palette of various instruments.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In 100, 200 years, yeah. you're in the classical tradition of composing, and you come up with music. You have a beautiful score to Joan of Arc.
Yes.
Which is touring the country.
Yes.
It's a silent movie from the 20s.
1928 by Carl Dreyer.
Beautiful movie.
I'm performing it September 29th in Bloomington, Indiana.
A hotbed of Joan of Arc fans.
Right. I'm excited because that show was booked 15 months ago. And everyone had just assumed we'd be, you know, done with COVID. But 15 months ago, we still, you know, but so, and then in October, I'll be at the Tucson Film Festival in Tucson performing it. So I'm like really happy that I'm able to travel and perform this.
Well, that's pretty cool.
And hopefully an LA date.
It's a strong piece. Well, let's talk a little bit more about electronica.
Okay.
I don't know if you heard of him. I just did a little bit of an homage to him because he just died. This guy named Vangelis. You know, a musician in the 80s.
I'm going to be on this Vangelis tribute. Okay. Coming out soon. I don't know. I don't have to. I guess I'm spilling the beans. It's a label out of Scotland. And I submitted a piece and it got in. So I was very happy about it. So.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. It's a choral piece, you know? And I think people are like, probably, I just assumed they were going to get a ton of submissions that's more synth based. But Vangelis also did a lot of choral music.
He was a composer.
Yeah, yeah.
Bottom line, that's what he was.
And his stuff is, I mean, like, his whole catalog's really good. There's a few things I thought was, like, interesting, you know, I just wasn't, like, totally on board, like the record he did with John Anderson from Yes. It was the voice that was, like, it was, like, a little too high for me. He's a ton of great work, and his choral music is excellent. So it's an excerpt from the Joan of Arc that I sent, and so I'm excited. When it comes out, I'll send it to you.
That's wonderful. Well, everything Mozart did wasn't great. Mozart has a lot of stuff.
Right.
Even Bach. This not everything that these composers write is fantastic, but the stuff that is really notable it just sticks around. But can you talk a little about the arc of this genre of music, the electronic genre? I mean, Vangelis wasn't the first. There was much earlier iterations. But just because you kind of understand how it's evolved, and then maybe talk a little about where it's going.
Well, I could only really talk from my experience. Like, I'm not a historian when it comes to that. And I definitely don't want to ruffle feathers.
But I think you have an insight that's important.
Yeah, because I was doing electronic music in the 80s when it was really a taboo. Like, it was, we got difficulty getting gigs. It was in the peak of hair metal day. And, I mean, people don't realize how bad it was. I mean,
The sounds were kind of cheesy.
It was like the metal, the whole hair, that they really hated anything outside of their genre, and they were like bullies and stuff. You know, these are like, you know, they were jerks. And
I see.
And so to get a show, it was like really, you could only play at a few venues. So we played at this, the goth clubs and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, music obviously was that, you know, appeal to that audience.
So they had to stick you someplace, and it was kind of goth.
It was industrial goth. I mean, okay. We got signed to an industrial label, KK Records, out of Belgium. And, I mean, our music is definitely dark wave and stuff. I mean, to this day, I still get people emailing me about that band, and
and
very proud of that work, but I as a musician prior to that, taking private lessons, piano lessons and stuff, I always knew I wanted to like do other things, and it was exciting for me to try to play other venues with that kind of music, because in Europe a band like Laibach would play an opera house, and Amsterdam Neubauten would play a performing arts center, so I really. And they were doing really intense work, but you couldn't do that here, you know, because it just, people didn't understand it. They didn't get it. It's before Nine Inch Nails. So, so we were limited to where we can play. I mean, I would submit, you know, back in those days, you know, you'd have to mail a club a cassette tape with a bio, you know, that's how you did it. Right. And it was like, you had to wait 2 or 3 weeks for them to reply. And all the venues I talked to said, no, this is, I don't know what this is, you know,
yeah.
whatever. So
being ahead of the curve, being a visionary isn't always a good thing.
Yeah. And when they were like, you use drum machines, I mean, it was a real prejudice against that. So I can only speak from my experience from that, but my first was Tangerine Dream, seeing the trailer for the movie, The Sorcerer. I was like 10 years old or 11 years old, and I just remember hearing that music. And back then, a trailer would also use like the theme. Now trailers for films, it's like a completely different music from the actual score, but back then they would play the score in the trailer. And
Vangelis was around that time too.
Yeah Chariots of Fire, right. Yeah, it was before that, but he was doing 74, whatever. But the first time I heard electronic music was a score for The Sorcerer. It was Tangerine Dream. And it was incredible. I mean, to this day, that piece, that music, the band still stands, you know. I mean, Edgar Froese passed away, but, you know, so that what started for me. And then hearing The Low Record by Bowie, which is an electronic album. It is, you know, Psy 2 is a pure ambient electronic album and one of the best ever made. And that came out in 77. I didn't hear it until 83, you know, because I was, you know, whatever. But yeah, started with, and then I saw another film, Midnight Express, when I was like 12, and that had Giorgio Moroder's score to it, totally electronic, totally synthetic, amazing, you know. So it was like the film scores that kind of for me did it with. So, but it wasn't until Bowie. The Low Record that I was just like okay, I want to, you know, be a synth guy. I was playing bass at the time. So then
you have like Kiana Scotzi come out, Philip Glass, and that blew up.
And then seeing Skinny Puppy, I saw them in 1988.
Jean-Michel Jarre had some very important work.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's kind of breaking into like, oh, this is cool.
Yeah. So I was also really into like the whole goth thing. I was listening to Bauhaus and Suzy and stuff. And when industrial music started happening, that music was also like, it became part of the whole goth scene. When I first went to a lot of the goth clubs, it was like death rock. It was more like post-punk that had a dark element. But then it really started, you started hearing bands like Laibach and Skinny Puppy and these electronic bands that was very heavy, very dark. And
were they on the West Coast?
Skinny Puppy?
Yeah.
They're from Vancouver.
Okay.
But they were on Capitol Records. They were signed to Capitol through Network.
And they made some sales, so they got some respect.
Yeah, and so by that time I was like totally all in electronic, doing industrial music. So
and then we have like the soundtrack from The Exorcist, which kind of blew everything wide open.
Yes.
That's
Tubular Bells.
Tubular Bells.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was great. But I said another life changing moment for me was in 1992. Stereo Taxi Device, my industrial band, we had toured Europe, and we got back, and I went to a rave. It was off the 14 freeway, and I saw and heard Aphex Twin perform in 1992, and I just completely blew my mind. And the music, this is the very first time I ever heard any glitchy IDM stuff. And I just, after that, I just couldn't go back to the industrial stuff. And I wanted to take electronic music in a way where it was like, it wasn't so much about being harsh and mean and scary, but more about like abstract and avant-garde, but at the same time very beautiful. His music is very beautiful. And so I just, yeah, and you know, then you move on. So that was kind of like this progression, you know, these things that happen. And you know, yeah,
that's the arc I wanted to hear. And IDM, intelligent dance music, I think at first I was having a real hard time connecting with it, and I think it kind of from there came Broken Beat. It was very abstract. IDM now is a little bit under the radar, but it kind of found its milieu and its footing,
yeah,
after a while.
I hear influences of that in pop music now. You know, there's things that I hear that it's like, oh, wow, I guess, you know. And there's like bands like Postal Service that definitely is hugely influenced by Aphex Twin. You know?
Well, Aphex Twin is like a powerful band.
Yeah.
And I will say that I am in the milieu where I use words like milieu. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Okay, cool. And, I was wondering about
that.
Yeah,
well, but... And then, well, you have like Spangl and... Well, you know, Pat, Alien Air on KXLU, he's got a whole show.
Right.
I guess we kind of ultimately met through Pat somehow, connection there. Dean De Benedictus.
Yeah.
And that whole crew.
Right.
So, yeah, you have a whole radio show featuring all this kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. Very fun.
Yeah, it's fun. Was that the word?
Yeah, fun. Whenever I think about...
So where are we? Yeah, so now, but it, like George Serra has taken all these concepts and this technology, and you've kind of like found your way back to classical music. Because you're using a lot of strings and woodwinds, and like it's kind of all merged in your work.
Yeah, I think I was like, to be really blatantly honest, and I've never said this, the reason why I've started working with string players again, because their level of musicianship and just their work ethic is something that I appreciate, because I was just tired of the person. And after 15 minutes of rehearsing, they have to take a break to smoke a cigarette or make a phone call. You know, it was just like this. It was just such a drag. Or like, you know, like they just weren't very proficient at playing their instrument. And it could work depending. You know, if you're in a like a total like garage punk band, that works awesome. But I'm not doing that anymore. And I was just like, it was like, instead of having a couple of synth players playing the synth lines, it's like, well, they can be played by cello, viola, and violin. And
interesting.
Yeah, so I it's like ambient music performed with real instruments.
It's all, and that's because the professionality of these people. And I will say, as a producer myself, when you work with people who have like training and classical training, it's usually a whole different caliber than somebody who's just figured it out or intuitive musician. Some once in a while it works, but that like years of practicing scales, there's no substitute for that.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. It's like, so I have this concert in Bloomington coming up, but before the pandemic, I was touring around the country playing my Joan of Arc score. Like, I was in Dallas, Milwaukee, Iowa City. Last show was Toronto, Canada. And I would find a local string quartet and four-voice choir, and I would send them the charts, PDF. and then so they can look it over, and then I fly into the town. So I'm not traveling with anyone. I work with local musicians, and I get there, and we usually only need one or two rehearsals to do an entire film score because
professional string
because they're like if I had to do that with like. You know, if I was getting a band together and I was like, you know, it's just people showing up. Like, I had a drummer quit on me because he couldn't find parking at a gig. You know, I mean, like, it was just like, he quit. I mean, yeah. he was like, oh, I can't do this, man. And he, you know, and it was over parking, you know? And I was just like, yeah, right, cool, dude. You know, it's like, thanks for wasting everyone's time. and, you know, just not going to get that from, like, say, a violist. Yeah, I quit because I couldn't find a meter parking spot. they're not. It's not even in their like worldview to have that kind of thought pop into their brain. So, so it's like I just like the fact that you know you need one rehearsal to do like an 80-minute live film score because they're used to doing that because it's not. That what up my score isn't like extremely complicated. It's not like you know the Brandenburg Bach. You know, where you know it's you have to be a good reader and you got to be proficient. But it's nothing where it's gonna be like over the top. It's like oh okay yeah I get it. This is pretty simple. I just like that. You know, it's just like you don't want that to be your major issue. You know, like you already got other things to deal with.
Most orchestral music for people who. Aren't classical musicians, it's written so that a professional musician can pretty much put it in front of them and they can play it. As opposed to if you're a soloist on a concerto, you know, this is something that has to be practiced and rehearsed for months and years. But most music, you put it in front of a musician, it's written so they can just play it, maybe a rehearsal or two.
Yeah.
But the technically... They have the proficiency to do this.
Yeah.
So 100 or 200 years, this is an interesting question, is like how much of the music today from the Beatles to Cher to... Yeah, how much it will be considered, oh, that's classical music, or as opposed to I don't know what else it is. And certainly, again, what you're doing seems like it's definitely kind of in that arc of... More like legitimate music.
I think it will be all considered classical because I think when at the time when Baroque and you know all these different you know I think they all considered it radical because it was something they've never heard or experienced.
Baroque music.
When it first.
Or classical, or Beethoven, yeah, these were actually radicals at the time.
Yeah, so I think.
They're not just like these antique wig wearing, stuffy people.
Right.
They were sometimes like visionaries and sometimes they were attacked for being
so it's like when I hear like Eric Satie's piano concertos, to me, that sounds closer to modern music than it does like. Early music, you know, like it, like if you know, if there's like a meter and it's like, you know, if it's at, you know, at 50, if you're right up there in the middle and it goes either 51% on one side or 51% on the other side, I think like Eric Satie's piano concertos are going to be closer to modern pop music than let's just say it's going to be like Schubert or something, you know, like I'm just saying, even though it's classical, but I to me, that has more of a modern sensibility.
No, those are fighting words, George Serra.
Yeah. So I think when people listen to... It's like in the future, they're going to listen to that and be like, yeah, that was like classical. You know, like...
That's now classical. But
yeah,
at the time,
like
it not, was...
Yeah, because it's so old and it's so... And who knows what they're going to be listening to in the future. It's hard to predict. I mean, I know people will be listening to music. I just don't know what it's going to sound like and what it is. You know, like I don't even know what... It's going to be, the good stuff will be played then, just like we listen to, you know, William Byrd and Gregorian chant, and we listen to, like, you know, we listen to Shostakovich, and we listen to, like, you know, Beethoven, you know, it's, the cream of the crop will always be around, I think.
Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, there was a riot after the first performance. It was an outrage. It was first performed on, I believe, May 29th, 1913. Avant-garde nature of the music caused a sensation. So these were radicals at times, mm-hmm. and it wasn't considered classical music in their day.
Yeah.
Well, what about George Serra in terms of what areas you personally want to explore? Where are you headed?
Well, there is an opera, a modern opera. So when I say opera, I'm talking like Philip Glass, Robert Wilson's work, you know, Einstein on the Beach, Monsters of Grace. That's just going to take a lot of work. But yeah, I need to record my Joan of Arc score because it's on paper, but it's pretty expensive to record it because I need a choir and a quartet. And, you know, like it's not like electronic music where I can just do it at home. So that's a little tricky. And I've had a...
So you might want to compose an opera.
I do, and I am working on it. And I've been working on it for a long time. It's just I do pieces because it's about space. It's about, you know, dark matter and stuff. And so every time I think I've made some headway, they make a new discovery about certain things. So it's like, okay, I got to cut. So I need to make it universal so it doesn't seem out of date, you know? Like it's... I can't get into specifics. You know, I can't, like, write a piece about Pluto and then find out Pluto's no longer a planet.
Right. This is interesting. A little scientific element.
Right. But so I got to make it so it's, like, way open-ended so that, you know, it's not going to be like, oh.
If you find if they find a fifth fundamental force and you only had four.
Right.
Ooh.
Right. So it's that. But it's something like that. Very obscure. And I don't know what it's about, and I don't think anyone else will. But it is going to be about like the cosmos and universe and stuff like that. And it's just stuff. I have ideas, and yeah. So I obviously, as long as the music's good and the presentation's good, it's like that's it. And you know, so you have a theme, but you don't know what the story is. And I think that's okay.
And allowing for some abstraction.
Mm-hmm.
Legit?
Yeah.
GeorgeSerraMusic.com for more information on George Serra.
Yeah.
Thank you. we see a long the sun upon its filthy shore, the bloated corpses of those killed the nights before. But it's a family show with art both high and low,
a tale of love
and death
and sex
and money, dancing and away we go.
Sweet Satina, who plays our ingenue, a sparrow singing up and down each avenue.
She wears a thin black dress and tells a tale of woe, of pain and loneliness.
But that's not all. As these things go, she's rather sick with some obscure malaise, no doubt a cruel trick from wilder, desperate days.
But one day, singing through her pain, the sun kicks out the rain, and there he stands, a lover.
Yes, one day everything changes when she meets a man.
A man unlike any she has known. He's,
A ventriloquist?
No, he's a matador striding across the sands of destiny.
No, he's a sailor.
Yes, a sailor. That's it. A man who has spent his life voyaging across the turbulent seas.
He's been searching for a mate, and now it seems like fate, a gift from God above.
A love divine forevermore, their bodies intertwine.
But fate has many other things in store.
There's a man who already claims her, an evil gangster who runs this town.
She's unhappy and no one blames her,
the most lascivious racketeer around.
He buys her love,
he buys her clothes.
He's rough, but this is all the poor girl knows.
He buys her love.
There's no escape, but now a triangle has taken shape.
And so the sailor, driven mad, determined to unseat this cat, swears to risk his life for love. And there's our show, all of the above.
A spectacle of savagery,
a testament to lunacy,
fun for the whole family,
and all of it designed by me.
So exciting,
the audience will stomp and cheer.
So delighting,
it will run for 50 years.
So exciting, make them laugh and make them cry. So delighting,
and in the end, should someone die?
So exciting, make our dreams reality. So
we are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, an extended interview with George Serra. We started the show with music from one of George's early projects called THC. The song was called Overfire. After the interview, from his project called Stereotaxic Device, Lost Land. Then music by Mute Math, Blood Pressure. That's from Mrs. Krishnan's Party by the India Inc. Theater, now at the Broad Stage in Santa Monica through July 24th. After Blood Pressure, we heard a selection from Ervo Part's Spiegel I'm Spiegel, featured in Airplay by Acro Bufos, also at the Broad Stage. That's July 21st through the 31st. Broadstage.org for more information on those two productions. Then music by Chopin, his Nocturne No. 2 in E-flat major, performed by Artur Rubinstein. You can see Hershey Felder's Chopin in Paris at the Wallace through July 24th, thewallace.org for more information about that production. And then we just wrap things up with a selection from the musical Moulin Rouge, currently at the Hollywood Pantages Theater through September 4th. That piece was called So Exciting, The Pitch. Go to BroadwayInHollywood.com for more information about wonderful musical theater in Los Angeles. We'll be back next week with more of the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out!